For the week of March 12th, 2017, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 359, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, bracing for weather, I'm Michael Gill.
Wait, weather? What's
weather? Well, there's always weather, but we're going to have a big blizzard. Oh my God. Planes have been canceled. They can't fly into town. I've got the IRAs, which is my annual movie award night. Every year, the IRAs get together. They've been doing it since the 70s. I've joined in the 90s, and they vote on the best films of the year, just like the Oscars. And every other year, they do something else. This year, it's the best films of the 40s. We'll be voting on those after a long, complicated buildup process. So that's going to be fun. And some people have had their flights into New York City canceled because of a winter storm warning, a big blizzard coming here late Monday night, Tuesday morning. It's Monday afternoon while we record this. And soon it'll be Tuesday and we'll be blanketed with snow.
And so let me ask you this. The IRAs, they don't stand for, you know, something, you know, in other words, it's the name of a person, correct?
His name is Ira.
Yeah.
That's right. Somehow the IRAs got named after Ira. They did call it the Independent Reviewers Association or something like that. They did make up a moniker, but it's just Ira.
Okay. Well, and so for all of those who can't make it in, will you gladly accept the award on their behalf?
Well, their flights, yes, I will. Their flights have been, well, we don't have the actual talent coming in. I don't think Orson Welles will be there to see if Citizen Kane or Magnificent Ambersons triumphs in the 1940s. It'll certainly be in the top 10, those two movies. But as far as what will actually make it, it's the IRA members, and they'll all make it eventually, I think. I think they just had flights, you know, like today and tomorrow, and those have been pushed around. So hopefully they'll be here by Friday.
Well, what about Casablanca? Do you think that will make it?
That is it's on the list. I mean, we have a list of 100 final movies after a lot of voting. That was my push for the best film of the 40s. Others scoffed at it, which shocked me. It should be in the top 10 as far as I'm concerned, without a doubt. But we shall see where it lands. I think it'll probably land in the mid 50s or something like that.
Casablanca.
It's, you know, it's all opinion. It's like the you know, American, what's the people who do the award, the AFI, when they do their awards, and it's just the consensus of a bunch of people, you tend to get the bland center of opinion.
There's so many ways you could go with that.
That's true. We could also go with beginning the show.
Oh, that we should probably do that, because this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we're going to be talking about China. You know why?
Why?
Because that's where it's happening. You know, the box office, the business deals, or the ones that aren't happening. The business deals that kind of got killed. And most importantly to Hollywood, the growth. During our book filter segment, Michael will talk about how global warming should be the hot new trend. Like zombies, only with higher sea levels. On Inside Baseball, we'll ask why unions seem to be gaining new traction in the world of New York theater, not to mention telenovelas. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the rest of the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. We're looking at box office around the world. We pull our information from ComScore. We have a link in our show notes. Also, Variety and Hollywood Reporter, Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, I said them already, we look at them twice, the New York Times, the LA Times, you name it, and the number one movie around the world is Kong, Skull Island, $142 million worldwide, a solid opening weekend, it cost $185 million to make, so it certainly needs to make a lot of money, we'll have to see how it holds. The news is pretty good in North America. It's certainly opening significantly lower than Godzilla, which is kind of the first in this new universe that they're thinking about. However, it built on the weekend. So from Friday to Saturday, it seemed to have good word of mouth. So they should be okay.
And you saw it and you thought, eh.
I thought it was fine. You know, it wasn't a good movie by any stretch. It was more fun than most, better than the last two King Kong movies, but certainly not a good movie. You know, the main thing is that there are no good characters or anything. It's just everybody sort of fades from your memory while it's happening. Brie Larson, Tom Hiddleston, Samuel L. Jackson. It just sort of, you know, none of them made any impression.
No good characters? What about the ape, the gorilla?
He was fine. He troubled, misunderstood. Also misunderstood is Wolverine. That's the number two movie around the world. Logan is the name. $107 million over the weekend. $440 million worldwide. At number three is the movie that just passed Logan at the Chinese box office. It's A Dog's Purpose. They've both been open there for 2 weeks now, I think. Last weekend, Logan was on top. This weekend, it's A Dog's Purpose, which had a great hold. It's made $23 million over the weekend, most of that in China. It's at $140 million worldwide. This movie, to me, is a big, big success.
Yeah, despite how it got started here in the U.S. with that rocky launch and, you know, kind of disappointing returns, it went on to make $140 million on a $22 million budget. That's a hit.
Well, and it's tripled its budget in North America, pretty much, pretty close to that. So that's a great result right there. Even if they didn't work anywhere else, they would have been okay. And number four is another successful movie. It's Get Out. It made $21 million over the weekend. And you know what? That would have been great on its opening weekend. But it's three or four weekends into the run, $111 million worldwide.
And it's in one market. Okay, so that's $111 million in one market on a $5 million budget.
We'll have to see how that travels overseas. Another interesting, movie to break down that ridiculous barrier of saying that films with black actors in the lead roles won't travel. They do, they can, and this one should. And number five is the Lego Batman movie, $12 million over the weekend, $275 million worldwide. Certainly a success. You know, it cost $80 million to make. It's more than tripled that. It'll probably quadruple that, but a little bit lower than the first Lego movie. So it's a spinoff to the side, focusing on one character. We'll have to see what that means for the Lego movie part two when that proper sequel comes out. And number six is another sequel. It's called Badrinath's Bride. It's a Bollywood romantic comedy, has a little light digs at patriarchy, but basically it's just a dumb romantic comedy. It got pretty poor reviews, but everybody liked the two leads. I don't know how much this movie cost, but it's a sequel to a film that cost about $5 million. It grossed $10 million on its opening weekend, which also happens to be the Holi Festival. That's the Festival of Colors. That's one of the few Hindu festivals everybody knows about now in the West, because that's where they throw all the powder, dye, and colored stuff at each other, and you see all those great visual images and photos and footage from the Holi Festival. Looks like a lot of fun.
Yeah, you know, right now on Google, they have those little banners that are animated and, you know, the Google logo.
I understand what you mean, yes.
I can't remember what they call that thing. But that said, it's a whole bunch of people running past the logo, you know, with powder and turning it different.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm looking at it right now. At number seven is The Shack. $10 million over the weekend, $32 million worldwide. All of that in North America. And number eight is La La Land, another $8 million, $416 million worldwide. And right below that, another big film that had a great triumph of, you know, Oscar nominations, Hidden Figures, just about the same amount of money, about $8 million, $200 million worldwide. And number 10 is Moana. This is the Disney animated film that's just about to pass the $600 million mark. So it will officially be considered by our standing on the side, not really looking at the books. We're just sort of guessing. Officially a hit. It tripled its budget. Every single big Disney animated movie is a really big roll of the dice. There is no way you should say that this is a disappointment. It tripled its budget. It made money. It got very good reviews. It will be a valuable part of the Disney library. And I think it's a reminder of how much we take for granted how well these movies do most of the time. You know what? This movie is a great success. There's no other way to paint it. You know, any movie that triples its budget makes money, even if it's a big Disney animated film and you're used to seeing them making more money. That's a success story, especially when it's a good movie, because you know it's going to be a valuable part of their library.
That's really, I mean, when you start looking at the downstream and history of a particular property, yes, I agree.
And my alarm went off. It's time to get my laundry out of the dryer.
What?
I have to get my laundry. I'm in a big building. You can't leave your laundry downstairs, even though it's been quiet as a church down there. There's nobody else down there in the laundry room, but I got to run and get my laundry. Okay, can you hold on a second?
Yes, I have no choice.
And I'm back through the magic of editing.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking while you were gone, you should probably have just left your laundry in the dryer. Maybe somebody would have folded it for you.
Oh, that would have been nice. I folded some of it, not all of it. I left the shirts and I haven't done the socks, haven't rolled them up because I wanted to get back and not keep everybody waiting.
Well, you know, not only through editing, we kept them waiting a much shorter period of time, but I think we may have been ventured into that realm of too much information to our listeners.
Laundry?
Laundry. Yeah, well, maybe laundry. Not.
Well, it's in terms of sharing information, there will be a show next week, but there won't be one 2 weeks from now because you'll be busy. What are you doing?
Going to CinemaCon.
Ah, there you go. That'll be fun. So we're not going to report live from CinemaCon. Oh, well. And there was something else. Among the lineup of stories this week, you didn't mention we have a letter from one of our viewers. I can't wait for the letter. Really excited about this letter. But, you know, it was great of them to reach out to us. How did they do that?
Well, they contacted us through email, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter. We're @showbizsandbox is our handle. Or you can like us on Facebook. If you search for Showbiz Sandbox, our page should come up. And Michael really, really loves it when you do any of those things and then complain about me.
That's right. Sperling gets spanked, which brings us to our next movie, 50 Shades Darker. $6.8 million on the weekend, $370 million worldwide. Then there's Resident Evil, the final chapter, another $6 million for that movie. That's at $307 million worldwide. Thank you, China. At number 13 is Sing, $580 million worldwide. And then there's Split. That's another horror film like Get Out, a big success around the world. $5.4 million on the weekend, $250 million worldwide. And then there's the movie I saw this weekend, John Wick Chapter 2. I saw three plays and one film, and that film was John Wick Chapter 2, in which Keanu Reeves had about 30 lines of dialogue and was unconvincing in 29 of them. I think I believed him when he said hello.
Right.
Just, he speaks in like 8 languages in this movie, which is hilarious. I mean, he speaks French. He speaks Russian. He speaks Italian. I think he speaks French. He speaks Italian. He speaks sign language. And in every language, I'm thinking, people who speak this language must just be going, oh my, I think it's a giggle for every country around the world. Sort of like how, you know, they put someone of every nationality in the Fast and Furious movies. In this movie, they had John Wick speak in like 8 languages. So everybody in Russia could go, oh my God, Keanu, oh my God, that's not how you speak Russian. Oh, Keanu, that is not Italian. So it was very fun.
Well, you saw three plays over the weekend. I finally saw a musical that you told me to see. And when it came to town, and I have to say, I knew very little about it going in other than, you know, it was based on a graphic novel. But Fun Home is absolutely amazing.
Oh, well, good. I'm glad you saw that. I wonder who was in it.
The little girl who was on Broadway and then the National Touring Company.
Not the original little girl.
Yes. She went on the national tour.
Oh, she did. 'Cause she left the show. So I'm a little surprised. Left the show after a while and was a little bit ugly. She felt like she should have been paid a little bit more money and they didn't come to terms. So I'm a little surprised she went on the tour. They must have ponied up.
Well,
but she was terrific.
Yeah, she was very good. And
she's the Tony winner.
Yes.
Yeah.
I believe so. Although maybe it was her replacement. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it was her replacement from the Broadway show.
Well.
Because I don't think that girl toured because they had an ugly breakup on Broadway. So.
Okay, well, and we should say it's Alison Bechdel's biographical graphic novel as a musical.
Yes, I wasn't a huge fan of it. I appreciated it. I liked it at the public. I liked it less on Broadway. It was never on my best of the year list, but it's certainly a worthy show to check out. And a great, you know, a great opportunity for someone in that one role of the little girl. She has a great part, but it's an interesting show, and certainly most people absolutely loved it.
You know, what's interesting, you mentioned that it started at the public, and I know this is like really far off of box office at this point, but mm-hmm. when you think about it, Hamilton, Fun Home, and I know the public has always done great productions, but they're on a little bit of a run.
Sure.
Okay. Well, all right.
Yeah. You know, I mean, they had Hamilton and they had Fun Home. So yeah, they're having a good few years. Jumping down in the box office a bit, Moonlight made $4.4 million. That's triple its estimated budget. Of course, they spent more to open it, but that is a great result for one weekend, and that helps it pass the $50 million mark worldwide. Just below that is La Traviata from the Met Opera. They had a live simulcast. $3.6 million in 7 territories. So that's a good result. Though we've had weird conflicting reports on how much it costs to do one of these things. I think the Met has it down to a science because they've been doing it for a while. And I'm going to be there tonight to see Idomeneo, the Mozart opera. So I'm excited to go to the Met.
Well, yeah, they do have it down to a science over there when it comes to recording these types of live performances. You know, there's some people, there's some reports that it cost about $1 million to $1.5 million to do one of these. Others say it's $250,000. I don't think it's $250,000 to record with, I think there are between 8 and 12 cameras are recording each one of these. But I do know that the Met gets to keep all of that footage for, well, in perpetuity.
Well, they shoot it themselves.
Right. And so they pay for it. They get to keep a lion's share of the gross here. And they really get to use that footage and those recordings, much like Moana, will make money down the road. So will these recordings.
Well, they'll release it on Blu-ray, of course, and DVD. Yeah. But no, there was some other people saying that it might cost multiple millions, like $2 million or $3 million to do a Broadway show simulcast, which we didn't understand. That made no sense. $1 million, I can understand. And of course, the Met has their equipment. They've been doing it for years. When they got it down to a science, I mean, they know how to do it well, and they've invested all the money in the infrastructure to do it. So they all they got to do is set up. But, you know, $3.6 million, you're saying they would get more than the typical 50% maybe or 40% from that worldwide gross?
Well, they might get around 50%, which would
be... For the total worldwide gross.
Right, exactly.
So that's $1.8 million. And then they own it and they can put it out on Blu-ray and DVD and all that stuff down the road.
Correct.
Jumping down a little bit, in China, there was another opening. It's Kingsglaive, which is a spinoff from the Final Fantasy XV video game. It's a Japanese animated sci-fi flick set in the world of that latest iteration of the Final Fantasy franchise. $3.4 million on the weekend, and it cost $6.5 million. I mean, it grossed $6.5 million so far worldwide. Not great reviews, not a great spinoff, as most video games turned into movies are. And that's about it for box office. Though there is a film that in Slovakia that did not make the charts, but it did have a great opening. It's called Kidnapping. Had the biggest opening of all time in the Slovakia. It's based on a true story from the 90s about the son of the country's leader being kidnapped. And it sold 67,369 tickets on opening weekend. So that's a record. So congratulations to them. And gosh, do I wish we had ticket sale numbers for every movie ever.
Well, you're not going to get them. I mean,
well, of course not. We can't go. I know we're not.
I mean, well, I just mean in certain territories, it makes sense to report by ticket numbers because the currency fluctuates too much. It doesn't, you know, doesn't really.
Well, it just makes sense historically because I would love to know how many people paid money to go see Gone with the Wind. And people have spent 2 years in the archives trying to figure that out. It ain't easy. It would be great. That's a thing that you don't have to worry about inflation and all that sort of stuff. I mean, obviously in China, you've had subsidized ticket prices. But nonetheless, people forked over money to go see a movie and sit down in the theater and watch it. And that's a wonderful metric that you could use throughout all of history. I mean, we know more people went to the movies in the 30s and the 40s, blah, blah, blah. But nonetheless, it seems really easy to compare admissions over time for just North America or worldwide or anything, as opposed to box office. You got to adjust for inflation or currencies in different countries and things like that. People bothered to show up, pay over some money and sit down. And that to me would be the gold standard of metrics, but we'll never have it.
Well, you know, speaking of currencies in different countries and the fluctuating nature of them, we have this story about, Chinese companies trying to invest in Hollywood, in various aspects of Hollywood. And really, there's one big, giant, 800-pound gorilla. No offense to King Kong. We're talking about the Wanda Group.
Well, are we?
Well, that's the 800-pound
gorilla. We're talking about a deal first with Paramount. Paramount had a $1 billion deal in financing, and those Chinese backers were the Shanghai Film Group and Huahua Media. I'm sure I'm butchering that. My apologies. Is that a division of Wanda?
No, it is not. I don't believe
it
so.
It is not. So, yeah, you were referring to the Dick Clark deal, I guess.
Yes.
Now, I'm sorry. So I jumped ahead there. Dick Clark Productions had a deal to sell itself for $1 billion to China's Wanda Group, and that deal is dead. It's been called off. And similarly, Paramount has had a $1 billion deal in financing from another group of Chinese backers. They were supposed to start forking over $140 million as part of the first payment to finance some of Paramount's slate. They were going to finance 25% of Paramount's slate for the next 3 years with an option for a fourth. And they're kind of it's not just the Chinese government slowing down the money flowing out of the country. In this case, the backers are like, you guys did not have your act together at Paramount. We'd kind of like to meet with your executives at Viacom and whoever you find to run the company, because that would be nice. And we'd like to find out what you plan to do before we start handing our money over.
Well, and it looks like Paramount is settling on a new leader after Brad Gray's departure. And of course, as expected, everybody's eyes turned to Jim Giannopoulos, who had been the head of 20th Century Fox for eons. And did a great job there and was kind of forced out for kind of quote-unquote fresher blood, younger blood, with Stacey Snyder. And now it looks like Paramount says, well, if you don't want him, we'll take him.
Right, but that's sort of that musical chairs of film execs. No comment on Jim Giannopoulos, but it's just like there's always like the same eight people who get shifted around into these, and they're all mostly white men, and it's kind of tiresome.
Well, that said, in a way, Wanda is associated with this Paramount news as well, because last year, they actually offered to buy a controlling stake in Paramount, and Sumner Redstone wouldn't have, you know, who is the owner, the 90-something-year-old owner of Viacom and Paramount Pictures and CBS, and he wouldn't have it, so Wanda went away. They instead decided to invest their money in Dick Clark Productions.
And now that's fallen apart.
And now that deal has fallen apart. Now, Dick Clark Productions, for those who don't know, they produce the Golden Globes, a New Year's Eve show, and the Country Music Awards. I believe it's the Country Music Awards. But in any case, they were going to pay $1 billion. And everybody, at the time it was announced, thought, wow, that is a lot of money for Dick Clark Productions. It almost seems like too much money. And how is it that they have all this money? $3 billion for Legendary Entertainment. I think it was $2 billion or $1.5 billion to buy AMC way back when. $500 million to buy Hoyts in Australia. You know, $1.2 billion to buy Carmike. $1.2 billion to buy Odeon Cinemas. And then there's like another deal that they're doing in Scandinavia that's hundreds of millions of dollars. And then they do this billion-dollar deal for Dick Clark. You almost begin to wonder what is going on here. Who is funding them? Well, the Chinese government steps in and says, you know what? We noticed that a lot of Chinese companies, specifically in the entertainment and media spaces, are buying properties overseas at inflated prices. And the reason they might be doing this is to get their money out of the country. And the government, of course, controls whether you can take your money out of the country and invest it elsewhere. And they're beginning to see their currency fall and destabilize. So in order to keep it stabilized, they want the money to stay home.
But that's not a great recipe for stabilizing the currency, of course, not allowing people to make investments and build their business. But there's no question about who is funding Wanda Group. There's no mysterious backers of Wanda. You implied who, where's their money coming from, as if they had more money than they should. That's not an issue here.
No. I mean, I think
that's what you said. Who's funding Wanda? Where's their money coming from? It's like, that's not in question.
Not entirely. I would agree with you.
Well, if there's something to tell me, tell me. I'm ignorant.
Well, I think there's some question as to they have very close ties to the government and whether they...
Well, you have to if you're going to be doing big business in China. Right. There's no big giant company in China that doesn't have close ties to the government, whether you're Alibaba or whomever.
So there's no question about, well, gee, is the government giving Wanda money to go do these deals? No. Are they giving Wanda money to do deals like real estate deals and preferential treatment on that score? Yeah, probably.
Well, you're saying two things, preferential treatment and handing over cash. Those are different things.
Well, that's what I'm
saying. The government is handing over cash?
No, I don't think so. No, I think they're doing it through actual business deals that just happen to fall Wanda's way in China.
Right. They're most favored nation status for Wanda is one of the things going on. You got the government backing you. Yeah. But there's no confusion about where Wanda's money's coming from when there's no like handing over of bullion so Wanda can invest money for government officials.
No.
That's not happening.
No,
at least
not at all.
That's not what you're saying. Okay. And, you know, it's true. Just about 5 years ago, the Dick Clark Productions was bought for a little under $400 million. So it's 2.5 times what they would have paid, 5 years ago. On the other hand, you do get to meet Ryan Seacrest.
That's true. He does the New Year's Eve show every year. For Dick Clark Productions. But I think here what the government is saying is, gee, you know, you're paying way too much money for some of these properties. And the only reason for you to do that is for you to get money out of this country. So
how does that help you? If you put money into a losing business and you lose your money, that doesn't mean you've secured your money overseas. What you're comparing it to is somebody, a rich oligarch saying, I'm going to buy a big apartment in New York for $20 million. And I can just, that means I'll have that money sort of stored there in the apartment. And if I want to sell that apartment, then I can get 10 or 15 or $20 million out of it down the road. And it's out of the country. That's what you're talking about as far as placing your money somewhere.
Correct.
But if you're placing your money in something that's going to collapse in value, that's not going to help you. That's not going to help you keep your money out of the country. That's what's going to lose you your money.
Well, it depends on how much money you would have lost in the country. So I agree with you. But I guess a part of it, I'm saying that even if it declines in value, it's not going to decline in value enough that it would be, they would earn less money than if they had kept their money in the country. And I think that's part of what, you know, the Chinese government is trying to
prevent. I don't think the government is saying this is a bad deal. There's a couple things. They're just trying to say, we don't want money flight. We don't want you investing money all over the world, and therefore we don't have access to it and can't tax it as easily the way we see so many countries around the world. Plus, we have the 19th Party Congress coming up in October. There's sort of a regulatory lockdown, so it's hard for things to get approved and new rules to go into place. And so everybody's just sort of holding tight a little bit. And they're saying, hey, everybody slow down. You know, we got another party Congress. We got to figure out what's going on. Stop throwing your money overseas. And of course, finally, there's just the fact that when it comes to Paramount, they got cold feet.
Well,
they said, this is not, maybe we don't want to do this investment. I don't know how they can back out at this stage, but when you're dealing with countries in different parts of the world, it's very hard to hold their feet to the fire when contracts, you know, you can't enforce a contract in China or maybe Russia. If you're in the U.S., it's hard to do.
Now, it might not come through on the recording for our listeners, but I'm wondering if maybe the Chinese are coming for you, or maybe you took somebody else's laundry, because I hear the police.
Could hear that. That was way down on the 14th floor. So that was very good. No, I think we're safe.
Okay. So whatever is going on, you're in a high crime area, maybe. I don't know. Or like I said,
if anything, it's Trump sending the people to get me.
Oh,
I've been blogging too much.
Okay. All right. Oh, my goodness. I thought, you know, maybe you said one too many things about Wanda and they
wanted to chat.
Yeah. Maybe just have a little conversation about that. Kind
maybe
of like the
conversation about books.
Yeah, I was going to say, kind of like the conversation we have each week about books during our Book Filter segment. And Book Filter is a book lover's best friend. Michael, each week you pick books that have been released during that week that the industry might be interested in, whether it's for optioning or for a television series. What books have you chosen for us this week?
Well, there's one book that I just think people who love movies might be interested in. It's Marilyn in Manhattan. It's a biography of Marilyn Monroe, and it's about her time in New York City, which lasted about a year. It was after her marriage to Joe DiMaggio collapsed. She came to the city. She took acting classes. She went to the Strand bookstore and hid in the stacks and started to read because she wanted to be taken seriously as not an intellectual, but she wanted to improve herself. And she did read a lot, and she was a very curious person, smarter than people imagine from that film persona. And it's just a sweet, charming picture of Monroe at one of the happier times of her life, which is rare for her, here in New York City. So it's kind of cool. It's got a great cover. And I think people who love movies, this movie might click for them. But my pick of the week is New York 2140. It's a science fiction novel by Kim Stanley Robinson. He's one of my favorite writers, just a terrific writer. And he's writing about global warming. He had a trilogy of books set on your part of the world, Sperling, on the west coast of the country, California, about global warming over there and how it would happen. It was a trilogy of books, and he just updated them recently with the latest scientific information, which was easy to do because basically all I had to say was, yep, it's exactly what we thought, but worse. So it wasn't really hard to update that. And now he's done a book set in New York in 2140. So he's just saying, what will it be like about 100 years from now? When certain events are going to happen, as he predicts, or as the science looks like it's pointing towards, what would happen if sea levels rose 50 feet?
Well, I can tell you this, you're on the right floor. The 14th floor is probably where you need to be.
Well, I'm actually on the right block, too, because Manhattan dips very significantly, as we saw during the hurricane, not Katrina.
Sandy.
What was it? Sandy. No, was it Sandy?
Yes.
Yeah. That flooded bottom of Manhattan. There's a significant rise right around 30th Street. The flood zone really raises up quite a bit. So if the flood levels, sea levels did rise about 50 feet worldwide, you would see all of lower Manhattan flooded to a certain level. But about 30th Street is, according to Kim Stanley Robinson, about where it would slow down and you'd start to have a lot less water and or dry land. So that's, I'm right, like just a block or two away from basically the waterfront. So it's a, of course it's a novel. It's about characters. It's about an investment analyst. It's about kids who are homeless living in their boat. It's about cops and all sorts of different people and their lives in this country. Real estate is a big player because the rich people are starting to want to move back in and they're trying to take over all the buildings in the intertidal zone. That's the area where they're slightly flooded and laws are different. When the seashore, apparently worldwide since Roman times, everybody gets to have sort of access to the seashore. That's not obviously true. You have some private beaches, but in general, everybody gets access to the beach and the coastline. You can't keep people off of there, and nobody owns right where there's some water.
Don't tell that to the folks in Malibu, especially David Geffen.
Exactly. So this is a big issue when all the coastlines around the world get flooded. Of course, first people don't want to live there, but when they move back in, it's sort of pirate, catch as catch can. And now that the things have stabilized, infrastructure is coming back, people are starting to live, the rich people said, I want that land again. And so you're getting all sorts of crimes and machinations and power plays to try and seize back that land. It's a fun book. I'm halfway through it. I've always liked what Kim Stanley Robinson does. And I feel like, you know, we had Waterworld, I guess. But I feel like there's a lot of ripe territory for TV series set in a post-climate change world. This book, New York 2140, there's a lot of great stories out there to tell miniseries or movies or TV shows that'll be really cool in this setting. That's, you know, it's coming.
Well, now you're recommending a book that you're only halfway through?
I am. I love Kim Stanley Robinson. I like his work, and I'm enjoying it.
Well, it must be good if you're, you know, recommending it on page, you know, 300 or whatever, you know.
Well, I wouldn't have had to read it at all. I would just say, hey, it's the new Kim Stanley Robinson. It's a good bet.
Okay, well, that wraps up our book filter segment. Moves us along into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, we are going to...
That was a tough transition. Yeah, that was just fun. Sometimes they don't know all the editing that goes on behind the scenes. That was a tough one.
That was definitely tough. Yes. It only took three.
And we're segueing right into another book story, so it's a perfect setup.
Yes, that is true. A few days after the bookstore chain Barnes & Noble reported weak third quarter results, Chairman Len Riggio spoke to a sympathetic industry audience. He insisted the company can and will become successful again. Somehow. It won't be by making their own e-reader. Because they tried that. It won't be by imitating the Canadian chain Indigo, which has made some success by de-emphasizing books and going broader with games and other stuff. And it won't necessarily be with all the new store formats they're trying out, like stores that sell beer and wine and more food. We call those restaurants, by the way, Mr. Riggio.
I bring a book to the restaurants that I go to.
Yeah. And this is all mainly because they keep trying out different formats, but they haven't found a magic bullet yet. They want to sell books, preferably without losing money on everyone they sell the way they did with ebooks. They just aren't sure how to do that and also stay in business. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal because when the head of your company has to say, by God, I'm pretty sure we'll become successful again, that's just not a good sign. Yeah. I'm amazed they're still around. I don't know what's going to happen to them and if and when they fall, and I feel more like when, it's going to be very bad for the book business. Very bad indeed.
It's going to be horrible, and you just can see it. It's just it's almost, as you say, a when, not if. And
yeah, there's no way people will be able to browse and look for books easily. There are lots of independent chains, but they don't carry the number of books, and they don't carry a lot of new releases. There's, you know, chains that mix new and used books, and all the new bookstores that open are like co-ops, and they're lovely. They're wonderful. I'd love to have a little charming, little friendly neighborhood thing, but they're not like a bookstore where you can go in and find the new Stephen King. So there won't be that showcasing of all the books. There won't be that presence all over the country, that footprint. You know, we've seen it with music, and that whole world has changed completely, and we're going to see it with books, and there's a lot of publishers that depend on Barnes & Noble to buy a couple thousand copies of their new book, and they use that money to help fund their publicity campaigns. There's a whole chain of stuff that happens when you have a big number one bookstore like this, and when that's gone, it's really going to have a massive, not a ripple effect, but a tidal wave effect.
going back to our 2140 reference.
Exactly, yeah.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, look, there's a Barnes & Noble in my neighborhood, and I go to it, but I think, wow, well, this is, you know, there's just no way this big giant store will last. It's going to affect real estate as well, because, of course, where are all of those stores located? But in strip malls and shopping malls, you know, somebody's going to have to become the tenant, one of those anchor tenants that Barnes & Noble's now acts as.
More bank chains, I guess. Yeah. I don't understand why banks need so many chains. I mean, in Manhattan, they're just literally on every corner. And I would think with ATMs, you would need fewer chains. So I just don't get it.
No, I agree with you. Here in where I live, they keep opening more bank branches and nobody can understand why, because it's like Starbucks. There's a Bank of America across the street from a Bank of America. It doesn't make any sense.
And yeah, I mean, that's clearly a mistake. And of course, I mean, I don't care what the traffic patterns are. That's just stupid. And of course, now I get a check. If I get a physical check as opposed to having direct deposit, you know, I just deposit it on my phone.
Yeah.
I don't need to walk into a bank. So I just don't get it. If you're working in the banking industry, what are you listening to our show for? But hey, tell us what's going on.
Well, you know, I think that I agree with you in regards to the whole the kind of independent bookstores. It's a really tough market to crack, even when you have the market to yourself. In Ketchum, Idaho, where I spend my holidays every now and again, there is a bookstore called the Iconoclast Bookstore. And just this year, over the New Year's holiday, I was thinking, well, it's really nice. This nice little bookstore, you know, it's not too big, it's not too small. It's got a little cafe in the back. People come in and out, but I'm there during one of the busiest weeks. Sure enough, by the end of January, they were announcing that they were closing after, you know, 20 years in business.
Oh,
and it's literally the only bookstore in this town. Now, the town, of course, only has, you know, maybe, you know, 10,000 people that live there full time, maybe. And it's, you know, it's kind of a rustic town. It's a ski town. But it's a shame that a bookstore and the only bookstore in a town like that can't make a go of it.
And it's probably not piracy, even though you can find books. Pretty much any book you can apparently find a pirate copy online, but it's so easy to get those books for a decent price that that's not as significant an issue for the publishing industry right now, at least in North America. But it is happening with video, isn't it?
Yeah, people all over the world watch pirated video, and many of them don't really think they're breaking the law. A survey of 25,000 people from more than 30 countries asked, this survey asked, do you watch pirated stuff? Okay, that was the question. 52% willingly said yes. 48% felt bad about it when told it hurts the industry and the people making the content they love, content like Game of Thrones. Most everyone realized you can't steal and then post pirated video. But it wasn't quite as obvious to them that just watching the stuff was also illegal, not to mention wrong. 87% of the people in Russia thought it was just fine to do, well, anything and everything.
Thanks, Vladimir Putin.
Yeah. As for self-reporting theft, that too varied by region. The country where people said they watched pirated video the least, guess where that was? That's right, the U.S. at 32%. Big deal or big whoop?
So are we just the biggest liars, or are we in fact the country that steals the least?
I think in part it's that so much of it is so readily available through legal means now.
Exactly.
That you know, there's less of a need to go through the hassle, frankly, of stealing.
When people were stealing Game of Thrones in Australia, it was because they didn't want to wait a month or 3 months for episodes that everybody was talking about online.
Correct.
I'm not justifying what they did, but the sooner and easier you make it available to them at a reasonable price, the less likely you're going to have pirating. And certainly in North America, we're lucky to have access to most stuff. I think some of the things that they do pirate the most here in the U.S. are probably British productions. You know,
yes,
we love British television, we love British things, and we don't want to wait. You know, you had Downton Abbey and you had a 6-month or 4-month delay. People are like, oh no, not that that's right, but that's what was happening.
Rock band Pearl Jam is looking forward to their April 7th induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And they're doing it in generous fashion. The hall chose to only induct 2 of the 5 drummers that have been with the band, ignoring 3 members, including Dave Abbruzzese, who played on both Versus and Vitalogy. Those are 2 different albums. Well, the band has no control over which lineup of the group gets inducted officially into the hall, but they do have control over who gets invited and who plays. So they've invited all 5 drummers with the band to join them on the big night. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, of course, in the scheme of things, but it's nice, and you wish most groups would do that. Dear God, you know, hey, if you've got, you know, different members. They have falling outs and all this sort of stuff. It's like, you know what? It's one night in your life. For God's sakes, bury the hatchet and just have everybody there. You don't have to like each other. You know, just get on stage and make music one more time. But I can see the problem. Like if the band Chicago, if everybody who played in Chicago showed up, they'd have to have a bigger hall.
Or Menudo, even.
Yeah, that's true. Exactly. Menudo got in the hall, there'd be 157,000 people up there.
Exactly. All
I
of Puerto Rico.
I wonder how many people have been members of Menudo. Good question.
Half of Puerto Rico. Okay. Political commentator Samantha Bee apologized this week for mocking a guy with cancer. Okay, she didn't intentionally mock a guy who had cancer, but she did. A look at the CPAC convention included a look at the buzz haircuts of some attendees, joking that they all had Nazi haircuts. Ha ha. Except one of those people later tweeted that, hey, he had a good excuse because, you know, cancer. Naturally, the show apologized, but the object of their disaffection made a bigger point. How about not making fun of people's physical appearance as a source of humor? And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big deal in a way. It's like, yeah, I think that person was absolutely right. You know what? Don't make fun of people's. Oh, look, they're all fat at the what? You know, it's like, no, just don't do it. Making fun of their haircuts is just A, it's not very smart or interesting satire or political commentary. And B, it's just mean and obnoxious. And that's what you're supposed to be fighting against.
But now, don't you think if you were to ask comedians, okay, so this is going off on a, and not to go off too long, but going off on a little bit of a comedian tangent here, if you were to ask a comedian, hey, are looks fair game for kind of making fun of? It doesn't matter whether it's political or not, just, you know, can you make fun of people's looks in a comedy bit? I think that you would hear more often than not, yes, that is one of the things, you know, that always gets a laugh or, you know.
Absolutely. And that's why most stand-up sucks.
Okay. Well.
And there were just about 39 members of Menudo, if you include New Menudo.
New Menudo? Is that like New York?
Yeah.
Okay.
Who knew?
Okay. Well, I love this next story. Rapper Future made chart history last week. Actually, he's been setting some pretty impressive records for a while since breaking out from the Dungeon family and being rightly dubbed The Future. He's collaborated on a full-length album with Drake, put out multiple mixtapes, and a string of studio albums. Including the album with Drake, he's had 5 number one albums in a row, and the last two made a mark when Future released an album 1 week, which hit number one, okay, so it was top of the charts, and then released another album the very next week, the following week, and then replaced himself at number one on the Billboard charts. Artists have replaced themselves before at number one, though not often. And no artist has ever debuted at number one with an album and then done it again with a different album 1 week later. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal, and I think it just points again how they just have to reimagine the Billboard Top 200. It's not the top 200 album sales, it's the top streaming. They
pretty
have
much
to redo it because it makes no sense. You know, none of this makes any sense anymore. How many albums did he actually sell? I don't know. Ed Sheeran just topped the charts. He has the number one song and the number one album of the week, which is great. First person to have both simultaneously since Drake back in, I think, July. His new album opened up with 451,000 equivalent album units in the week ending March 9th. Most of that due, of course, to all the streaming we talked about last week. So that's great, but they're just trying to shove streaming into a sales box, and it's not working. They just need to say, who's the number one streaming artist of the week? What's the number one streaming song of the week? What's the number one streaming album of the week? Which I think should mean 40% of the album was played by an individual user, not one track 20,000 times. And just have those three metrics. And then you can have a sales chart. And that clearly is going to be the far less important chart. But the Billboard Top 200 albums should be Top 200 streamed albums. And probably the most important thing is the top streaming artist of the week. You know, however that comes about. That's probably the most important metric. And that's what it should just be. The Billboard's Top 200 streaming artists.
Well, now let me ask you something. You don't buy albums because they're all sent to you for review purposes. But do you have friends and family members that still buy compact discs?
I have very, very, very few. Not compact discs, no. I have a friend who buys LPs and he's a music fanatic. I do have people who buy some digital albums. I can't think off the top of my head of anyone who buys a physical CD, no.
Yeah, I do because I like to support the artists and I go out of my way.
Buying their digital album supports them too.
Yes, but for some reason I just feel like, you know, I'm a child of the 80s. What can I say?
No, I know, but I'm just saying they make money off an album sale, whether it's digital or,
I know.
Yeah. Okay.
Another day, another online streaming service with some TV shows you can chip in $5 or $10 a month to access. Kind of like Yay! Spotify. Yeah. A few months ago, it was Filmstruck, a collaboration between Turner Classic Movies and Criterion. Last week, it was BritBox, a BBC offering, so no longer the need to steal all those Doctor Who episodes. This week, it's Boomerang, an offering from Time Warner. Like the cable offering, Boomerang specializes in cartoons from the glory days of Looney Tunes, Hanna-Barbera, and MGM. So you'll find a rotating library of new and classic cartoons drawing on 5,000 titles, including Bugs Bunny, Scooby-Doo, Tom and Jerry, The Jetsons, and The Flintstones. The cost? About $5 a month. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal for a couple reasons. One, I can never figure out in these stories when they say 5,000 titles. I assume they mean 5,000 episodes.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Right. It's so annoying. Just tell us that. Don't say 5,000 titles. Like, you don't mean 5,000 TV shows with 80,000 episodes. You mean 5,000 episodes of multiple shows. So if you have one show that has 10,000 episodes, like Sesame Street or whatever, who knows how many they've done over their lifetime, you know, it's just, you know, Captain Kangaroo. You got that in there. That may be 20,000 episodes right there. So be specific on that. Two, what we didn't quite say was you have a rotating library of new exclusive episodes and classic cartoons. New episodes of Scooby-Doo, Tom and Jerry, and Looney Tunes will appear only on the Boomerang website app. They will not be on the Boomerang cable channel that you're already paying for on your television. They are punishing you for paying $90 or $100 a month for cable. They're punishing you. Just like CBS is punishing you if you want to watch The Good Fight, tough noogies.
Well,
if you want to watch the next Star Trek, nope, it's not happening. And to me, this is a big problem. It makes sense. I mean, Netflix doesn't have exclusive content that they're not making available anywhere else. That's where they live. When you are Boomerang, there's no reason to punish people who have your cable channel.
Yeah, well, there's reasons for that are too lengthy to go into on this show.
Well, I'd love to know. They're not good ones because you're screwing over your own business.
No. I wholeheartedly agree with you. They are trying to – remember, they're going direct to customers when somebody pays them $5 a month.
But they're not there yet.
Oh, I know. I agree.
You want to make the service valuable enough so that if they have just the service, they're happy. But punishing the people that you already get – I mean – you know, it's like if ESPN does a digital app and like, oh, but you can only get baseball on our app. Like, what? you're just cutting off the knees of cable, and that's still a huge source of money for you. I think it's just a mistake.
Well, somebody who's trying to make the digital divide and cross that digital divide is Bob Iger, okay? And multinational corporations are still trying to figure out how to position themselves in the age of Trump. Smaller, less established companies like Uber, although I can't imagine you could call that small. Well, Uber felt so much heat for being associated with the president of the United States that its head backed out of serving on corporate advisory boards. Others, like Elon Musk, are independent enough to feel they can scoff at public opinion, with Musk insisting he'll be a positive influence. Good luck with that, by the way. Disney, of course, is not small or independent. So the company's CEO, Bob Iger, has had to publicly address serving on a board of advisors for Trump. He says he can be a positive influence on the president, while critics say he's providing a fig leaf of respectability in exchange for tax breaks and other favors his company can benefit from. Conservatives also criticize Disney, saying their news division at ABC caters to liberal elites. The main takeaway Iger seemed to take from critics is that, unlike presidential press conferences, shareholder meetings aren't much fun anymore. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop. They had a shareholder meeting and people yelled at him. It happens all the time. But they are feeling some heat. People are, you know, talking boycotts, so people aren't going to stop going to Disney movies, but they don't like any bad press. So maybe that'll have some effect on them. We'll have to see. Or maybe he can claim some success in changing the president's mind on some issue. I look forward to hearing about that. But I referred to Uber as smaller and less established because they feel like such a house of cards to me. You know, they lost $2 billion this year. We're going to lose $3 billion next year. They're trying to leverage their apparent worth into being able to buy a bunch of self-driving cars so they can have an actual business that might pay off down the road. Right now, they're losing money hand over fist. And everybody I know is switching to Lyft. We'll have to see what happens with them.
Is that because of the political ramifications of Uber?
That's right. You're seeing their business in major cities. It's just very easy. As soon as someone downloads Lyft, it's just as easy to press one button as the other.
Yeah, I mean, there's no lock-in to Uber.
Right, there's no lock to it, other than if they have a ton of drivers and everybody I know who drives for them, it's a crappy experience.
Yeah.
I don't think it's good experience for people at Lyft either. They might do a little bit better today, but I don't think long-term, these are all businesses where like, yeah, you use your car and you work for free. You're your own boss. Good luck with that.
HBO Latin America is ramping up TV production in a big way. They announced 14 new projects, including 7 reality shows, 2 documentaries, 4 fiction series, and the first late-night talk show in Brazilian history featuring comedian Gregorio de Vouvier. And this is a quote. HBO already produces more original local content than any other premium subscription entertainment service in the region, and we have never had a portfolio of exclusive productions with the volume and breadth of what we are presenting today. And that was said by Robert Rios, Corporate Vice President of Original Productions, HBO Latin America. Big deal. Big whoop.
Roberto Rios. Thank you very much.
Sorry.
I think it's, most of these are pretty, they don't seem hugely expensive, reality shows, documentaries, etc. What I'm fascinated by here is, of course, a bunch of shows just in Brazil. That shows a real investment in Latin America. What are they going to do in the other countries? Are they going to feel left out? Or these are obviously meant to appeal to everybody in Central and South America and in North America and around the world. But late night TV is fascinating to me. It's their first late night talk show in Brazilian history. In the U.S., it's been around so long that it just seems part of life. That's, you have late night talk shows, Carson or whatever. In the U.K., just within the last 15 years or whatever, Graham Norton launched a nightly talk show. And people are like, what? Every single night? Are you out of your mind? It just was something they'd never done. They didn't think about, oh my God, it seems so crazy. And it's been a big success. And it's funny to realize how much all over the world that has not been a thing.
And if you notice, shows that like James Corden does have kind of taken a bit of that Britishism, if you will, format from the talk show. And rather than have guests come out one at a time and then leave, he keeps them all out there and they kind of do a panel discussion.
Well, the Graham Norton approach, yeah. There must be others who have done. There have been obviously talk shows in the U.S. where they kept people on. So eventually you developed a panel. But yeah, right. He brings them all out at once.
Correct. Are you dying, by the way, Michael, to return to Pandora?
I am not.
Yeah, I know a lot of people who aren't either. Probably not as much as 20th Century Fox, though. They're really dying to return. But we're all going to have to wait a while. Director James Cameron says 2018 is out of the question for the first sequel to Avatar, the highest grossing movie of all time. In fact, the Disney theme park Pandora opens this summer, at least a year and a half before we'll see Avatar 2 hit movie theaters. Cameron points out that they're setting up and shooting 4 massive films all at once, doing the Lord of the Rings one better and frankly at a much bigger budget. So hey, they want to get it right. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. The theme park issue seems to me to be the biggest because they have to launch this park. It's a whole section of. It's not like a single ride. It's a whole section of the Disney World franchise, and they have to lock in what they're going to show and what it's going to look like years before the movies come out. That seems to me a big problem. I felt like they jumped the gun doing it after just one movie. They better hope it's not a Matrix type thing. But more importantly, it just seems like it'll be dated by the time part 2 and 3 come out, because there's going to inevitably be stuff and looks and elements that cannot be in the park. And it ain't easy to switch those things up once they're locked into place.
I agree with you. I kind of look at this and go, you're going to shoot 4 movies. You better hope they're good, because you can't go back and go, yeah, actually, well, we released number 2 and it turns out the storyline is horrible. And now we're stuck in that for, episodes 3, 4, 5, and 6. And oh, by the way, there's all this ancillary stuff going on, as you've mentioned, Michael, where, you can't change it at all. And as you pointed out, it is beginning to feel a little bit stale. In fact, if you show a 7-year-old what, those creatures from Avatar, they may not even know what you're referencing. Because
I wasn't looking forward to it, but I'm sure I will be there on opening weekend or see it at a preview to see what it looks like and what he's done technologically speaking. I'm sure part 2 will make a lot of money. The original was the highest grossing movie of all time. And I'm sure that making 3 or 4 movies all at once will be cheaper than doing them individually. The Matrix movies all made money. Even though the last one, fell off a cliff a bit, certainly creatively, even if they're not creatively good, they'll probably make their money just on 1 or 2. If you make a movie that makes $2 billion and all 4 of them cost $800 million to make all at once, right? You've made your money back with 1 movie.
Yeah.
So, the other 2 or 3 are gravy. So maybe they're going to spend $1 billion making these four movies. I don't know how much it'll be all told, but I don't know what their budget is. I'm mostly thinking about the theme park, how what a nightmare that is.
That wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you.
And Dios mio, what's going on here, Sperling? Something's happening at Telemundo.
Yes, actors voted overwhelmingly, and these are actors that they appear in telenovelas, okay? And so on Univision, there are these telenovelas, and these actors have not been represented.
Well, Telemundo is different. It's not Univision.
Sorry, yes. I get them mixed up all the time. And they don't even start with the same letter. So Telemundo and Univision are separate.
And Telemundo is owned by NBC Universal, which may have been part of your problem.
Yes.
But these are actors who appear in telenovelas and other programs. I don't think it's just telenovelas, but maybe I'm wrong about that. But however,
they voted to join SAG-AFTRA.
Right, and that's the largest employer of Spanish language performers in the U.S. That is Telemundo. And they said, we want to be part of a union. And they did it overwhelmingly. And similarly, we've seen some more action off-Broadway. The Off-Broadway League and the United Scenic Artists, which are the set designers, they signed their first ever off-Broadway contract. And that goes into effect in July. And that follows a deal just a little while ago for off-Broadway actors that gave them a significant pay raise and recognized that, hey, you know what? People working off-Broadway, they have to make a living wage or at least a somewhat livable wage. So that is happening off Broadway. This is happening at Telemundo. I know casting directors are agitating on Broadway to try and get part of union recognition for their work that they do, because they're one of the few areas on Broadway that is working without a union contract. And I'm wondering, why is this all happening now?
Well, I think it's happening because that living wage thing you just mentioned. NPR interviewed one of the actors in these telenovelas. And, you know, he's this strapping, hunking guy, you know, that everybody, you know.
He's a hunking? A hunking?
You know, hunky guy. You know, that's hunky, the way hunky, he was described hunky. As, you know, basically a model-esque, you know. He doesn't have a six-pack. He's got an eight-pack. That's how hunky he is. And needless to say, he was being asked about, you know, why join a union now? And he's talking about the fact that he does these shows. He gets paid very little to do them. And then they appear on Netflix and all of these streaming services for years on end. And the, you know, Telemundo profits from them. They don't get any residuals, the actors. And what does he do when he's not acting in a telenovela? Well, he's an Uber driver.
It's kind of like being a school teacher.
Yeah, and when you think about that, you know, you don't see soap opera stars in English language soap operas, you know, acting as Uber drivers, or maybe you do, but they certainly don't get the attention that, and neither did telenovela actors until just recently.
Right, they don't make a lot of money, and you know, we've had 4 decades of people not making any job growth. Wages are flat or stagnant. They feel like they're falling further and further behind, and they're finally saying, you know what? One way we can have a little leverage with our bosses, as we're all sort of treated as independent contractors, which means we get paid dirt with no benefits, they need to join a union. And you can see, you know, the world that we live in. ESPN just announced they're firing more on-air talent to save more money. They're looking at declining subscribers and costs to get sports are rising and rising and rising. They're looking at going solo via an app or a website a la HBO. And they're saying, we got to cut money somewhere. We can't cut it by not having baseball. So we'll cut our on-air talent.
Yeah, soon they'll just cut to a game. Nobody will be saying anything. It'll just be game.
Yeah, they do that now sometimes in the UK with you know, some cricket and some others. But yeah, it's just, you can see that online. We have live simulcasting of multiple games of tennis. When you go to the U.S. Open, you can watch the U.S. and the Australian and the French. You can watch court 12.
Yeah.
You know, there may not be a commentator there, but if you want to watch that match, you can online, which is great. But the on-air talent is like, hey, I'm at ESPN. I'm on air covering sports. And you don't feel like you have a secure job.
Well, yeah, it's pretty remarkable. I mean, by the way, the Lakers had something, I think they called it courtside for a while, where it's just a camera on the side of the court and you could watch the game from there. There's no talking or anything like that. It's just the game.
You were just sitting next to Spike.
Yeah. Well, no, not Spike. Spike Lee is at the Knicks game.
He might have come into town.
You were sitting next to Jack.
Oh, there you go. Of course,
yeah.
Jack.
Yeah, Jack Nicholson. Okay, well, that wraps up. I keep saying that wraps up, you know, as if I got to come up with a better segue. But in any case, that was our Inside Baseball segment for this week. And Michael, here is the moment you have definitely been waiting for, our listener email to dirt@showbizsandbox.com.
That's so exciting.
Yes. Now, the listener wishes to remain anonymous because they work in the industry and don't necessarily want to hear about this from their boss.
And yeah, most people are not authorized to speak to the media.
That's really, yeah. And so these days, everybody's really cautious. And so, Michael, take it away.
That's right. Most people write in to say, Michael, stop being such a jerk. Why are they doing that? Well, because I'm a jerk. So it's nice for a change to have somebody come in and chide Sperling for his information or knowledge. So this is fun. Sperling, I thought you knew VPF deals better than that. What is a VPF deal?
Virtual print fee. That is the fee that a studio or distributor pays to a movie theater or integrator, a movie theater, you know, a digital cinema integrator, for the use of the projector. This was done to make the transition from film stock to digital cinema.
Right. In the old days, you'd have to pay a fee for a print.
Correct.
A print of a film to be struck and shipped over there. Now, even though it's digital and you don't have those expenses, you still got to pay a little something. So he says, Sperling, I thought you knew VPF deals better than that. Quoting $800,000 for Moonlight's expansion is ridiculous. We were talking last week about Moonlight expanding from 500 screens to about 1,500 screens. And Sperling said he estimated it would cost about $800,000 for that expansion. I'm sure you know that all of the later VPF deals have a variety of mechanisms such that a film re-expanding late in its run would not be paying full VPS for every screen that they played on the prior week. Some very early VPF deals may not have had this, but those early deals should have all run their course by now, so those screens would be VPF free in any case. It is an absolute certainty that Moonlight's expansion cost them very little in VPFs. And with their ability to generate $2.5 million that weekend of box office while drafting off both the Oscar buzz and any marketing that was being done for the home entertainment release, it was likely a small but profitable release. Not to mention that the round figure of $25 million, which is the gross that the movie passed in North America, might very well be a threshold to a higher level of fees in the downstream licensing deals, as you mentioned. And that's from someone who wishes to remain anonymous. So, Sperling, you said $800,000 was your estimate for that movie, Moonlight, to expand from 500 screens to 1,500 screens. After him pointing this out, you said, all right, actually, maybe it was more like $2,000 per screen, which would have meant...
No, $200 per screen, but then I went
then, which would have meant about $200,000. And then you said, actually, to clarify even more, now what do you think?
Well, okay, after looking at two different VPF deals, all of which are confidential, by the way, and I can tell you that in most instances, if you come back to a screen after the fifth or sixth week from release, you're paying $0. So you're not paying at all. If the theater owner decides to book the film and play it, they know they're not getting a VPF. And that
because basically this happens very little.
Yes, and that is true even if you're not coming back to a screen, but actually being booked the first time, what they call off the break, meaning the film has been released widely and it's out. The release date was 5, 6, 7 weeks ago. You're paying very little, if anything, to play on that screen for the week.
So mostly we're talking about, I guess, award season time.
Correct.
That seems to be the most likely. Perhaps something like, this wouldn't come into play for a reissue like Purple Rain, would it?
No, that would be, especially since that is just a one-off where they're showing it one day, or maybe they showed it all weekend, I don't know. Yeah. That would be, actually, they might charge a special screening fee, which is a per-showing fee that you pay. Especially if you're just doing it for the weekend, they might say, okay, rather than a whole VPF, since you're not going to keep it the full 2 weeks, just pay per screening, and then you'll, you know, I think it's like $25 to $50, somewhere in there you'll pay. And that's for, you know, the Met Opera, for instance, pays that fee.
So if they wanted to, say, blast a couple of the most recent Fast and Furious a weekend or two before the new one, just to sort of prime the fans for the new film, that wouldn't qualify for this either because it was like a year ago or 2 years ago?
Well, and you're not doing you're not actually booking a full week. What you're doing is you're saying, no, it's going to be one or two screenings or, you know, maybe a weekend, just on Saturday night or just all day Saturday. Then you'd be paying special screening rates.
So this happens very little, and it only happens probably because of award season time. We'll try to think of another reason. And it only happens because the movie theater says, yeah, sure, okay, let's do it.
Right, and I should point out that, look, these things started to get signed, these VPF deals started to get signed 10 years ago, 12 years ago. And at this point, a lot of these deals, or some of these deals, I should say, are expiring. So there's no VPFs for them anyway.
Are they finally getting rid of VPFs, period?
Well, remember, the VPF was only for the transition. It was only for theater owners to afford the equipment to transfer and convert to digital cinema. Now, the theater owners had to pay for all of that equipment. However, the benefit, the cost reduction and in operating expenses was on the distributor side. So it was kind of like, okay, I'll spend a whole lot of money so that you can save money in your manufacturing. No, you know what? Hey, you're going to save money in manufacturing if I spend all this money. You pay me back. And in the long run, you'll save money, but it'll be 15, 20 years from now. And sure enough, you know, 10 years down the line, these VPFs are expiring. The studios don't have to pay them anymore on certain screens, and they are saving money.
But the second they need new equipment, which is going to happen, are they going to be able to get the studios to pony up again?
In every VPF I ever saw, the entity that signed the VPF, the theater owner that signed the VPF, was not allowed to ever charge the studio again for a virtual print fee. So the answer is no. However, there, you know, that's the entity that signed the VPF, not necessarily the entity that, you know, starts tomorrow and is in, you know,
it seems there'd be very little incentive, obviously, for an exhibitor to want to upgrade their equipment to some new fancy format when all it's going to do is help the studio. Or is this going to be seen more as a technical upgrade a la better sound?
Yeah. And I think that's where as equipment breaks and it has to be replaced, then it will be on the theater owner to do that. And ideally, the theater owner will be replacing it with equipment that is better and allow for a more technologically advanced presentation, whether it's in, you know, high dynamic range or larger screens or better sound, that would give it a competitive advantage over other theater owners in the market.
So print fees back in the old days, was that not a profit center for exhibitors? It was simply something to cover the cost of what they had to do to get the film print to their theater and put it in the spool.
Well, print fees never existed, meaning the I should take that back. Print fees on the exhibition side, the theater owner side, never existed. The studio had to pay a lab to make a print. Yes, that they did have to do that.
The cost of putting the film out.
Right.
So they saved money. So theater owners, just the way they had to buy their equipment to show it.
Correct. And they would fix that equipment until literally the screws were falling out and they couldn't, I mean, they would have projectors that lasted 50.
The bulb was dim.
Yeah, it didn't matter. And now, of course, look, you're basically, you have a computer. You are using a computer to show a movie. And I would ask you, are you still using the same computer you used 10, 15, 20 years ago? The answer is no. You don't even have the same phone you had 10 years ago. So,
will they charge a bulb fee? Would that be something that everybody could get around to say, you know what, the theaters need to start using better bulbs and using them properly, and the studios need to encourage that to have the best film experience? Is there a way to have a bulb fee just so they won't try and nickel and dime the audience with a crummy, you know, dim projection?
I highly doubt that studios would go for that. They're trying to pay less for everything. So, you know.
Well, you know, if I make a mistake on the facts, email me directly. But if Sperling makes a mistake, you know, reach out to us at Showbiz Sandbox, right?
Yes, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. And that is what this listener did. And I must say that I always hate whenever I quote numbers like that, because I know that when I'm doing it, I'm like, you know, I know there's, I should really be thinking about this first. I totally forgot about the fact that, you know, when Moonlight expanded, it was expanding off the break. So there's, you know, it was already out for months, you know, 2-3 months. So there would be no VPF, or it would be very, very little. And so I said, well, okay, let's take a worst case scenario.
You made a mistake.
Let's say, yeah, let's say it's $800,000. They still made
you
money.
You made
right?
a mistake.
Yeah, I made a mistake. So thank you for pointing that out to me, everyone. Now, you could actually call and also tell me that I've made a mistake. 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter at Showbiz Sandbox is our handle. You can like us on Facebook. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox and up our page should come. All of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find all the links to the stories we discussed on today's episode and all those ways to follow us and email us. And I guess that would be it. And subscribe. I keep forgetting to mention this. You can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can subscribe to us, you can rate and review us, and we do appreciate it when you do that. Again, showbizsandbox.com is our website. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their own website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Gills has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's SperlingMadeAMistake.com.
Okay, well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to the Huffington Post or MichaelGiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. And as always, don't forget to check out BookFilter.com. Some of my work can be found on CelluloidJunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.